One of the great things about the Arabian Nights is they appeal to very different audiences. For kids, they're full of exotic and magical creatures, but they're also complicated stories for adults, full of sex and intrigue and even murder. TV producer Shabnam Rezai grew up with these stories in Iran, and she's never forgotten them.
The story goes that the king comes home one day and he finds his wife in bed with all these slaves, and of course she's cheating on him, so he's enraged and he goes into a mad fit and takes out his sword and kills her right there and kills all the slaves. And beyond that, he gets really upset and puts out a decree that says, I'm going to take a virgin wife every night and kill her the next morning.
Because he doesn't think he can trust any women.
Women can no longer be trusted, that's right. So now we have a situation where he goes through all the virgin women in the town and they're all dead and we're only left with one woman, and this is Shahrazad, as you say, the daughter of the vizier. The night before she goes in, she asks her little sister, Donyazad, to come into the bedroom and ask for a bedtime story. And of course, that night, after the king is done with Shahrazad, Donyazad comes in and says, Sister, it's your last night on this earth. Would you mind parting with us with a good bedtime story? Now, what's very clever about Shahrazad is that she doesn't tell the ending of the story. So right at that cliffhanging moment where we're dying to find out if our hero is going to die or survive this ordeal, she says, you know what, guys? I am a little tired right now and the sun is about to come up. So why don't we take a break and we can follow the rest of this tomorrow.
Sort of like the template of every TV drama.
Absolutely.
You know, it always ends with the cliffhanger.
Is this not the most modern version of the commercial break?
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time you go out on a TV show that you're watching, they always give you that cliffhanger. And it was invented in the 9th century. I mean, it's brilliant.
She's the ultimate entertainer, the wonderful tailspinner. And one of the things that's difficult when you're trying to write about the Arabian Nights is that the stories are complicated.
Marina Warner is a cultural historian whose book about the Arabian Nights is called Stranger Magic.
They're subtle and ingenious, and the way the details and the plot unfold are definitely in the hands of a skillful embroiderer.
Night after night, Shahrazad stayed alive and kept her head on her shoulders. At last, after 1,001 nights had gone by, the king turned to her and said, Shahrazad, I shall never grow tired of you, and you shall be my queen for as long as we both shall live.
There's something irresistible about the Arabian Nights. It's not just the narrative structure, the stories within stories, or the triumph of Shahrazad in a man's world. It's this whole fantastic universe. I mean, think about it. Centuries before Harry Potter gave us flying cars and floating chandeliers, these were stories packed full of magic.
The djinn, you know, who are the genies who drive the action and who are good and bad. They can go both ways, so they're wonderfully unpredictable. The flying carpet, all the enchanted objects, all this landscape of possibilities opened up doors for people to imagine other worlds.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cosmology of the Arabian Nights, the djinn. We now often refer to these characters as genies. What role do they play in these stories?
They're rather like our fairies. So whereas we think of as fairies as part of the past, the genies and the djinn of the nights are canonical. They're in the Quran. They're made of shimmering fire, or they're made of water. I mean, they're elemental. They have charge of the wind. They're kind of airy beings. And one of their tasks in the legends and the mythology of Islam is that they carry Solomon through the air on his throne.
Solomon is the all-wise king who presides over this world.
Yes, yes. Solomon is just like the Solomon in the Bible, except he's got more extraordinary stories attached to him in the Arabian Nights. He's the master of the jinn. And because and the disobedient jinn, the ones who refuse to acknowledge the truth of Allah after the revelation of the Prophet, and the way they're punished is that Solomon shuts them up in copper bottles and tosses them into the depths of the ocean. And that, as you will remember, is the beginning of the famous scene when the fisherman fishes up one of these copper bottles and it's all covered in barnacles and rust. And he opens it and out swarms this huge pillar of fire, which is the imprisoned genie, and he will give the fisherman everything he wants.
So what'll it be, master?
You're
gonna grant me any three wishes I want, right?
Almost. There are a few provisos, a couple of quid pro quos.
Like?
Rule number one, I can't kill anybody.
Yeah, so don't ask.
Rule number two, I can't make anybody fall in love with anybody else.
You little punim there.
Rule number three.
Over the last decade, the Arabian Nights have become the subject of intense scholarly interest. There's no better example of how Middle Eastern culture was absorbed by Europeans and how it all got mixed up together to create something new. In fact, Shebnam Rezai says the title of these stories, The Arabian Nights, is actually misleading.
The original tales are called A Thousand and One Nights. And what happened was when they were first brought over to Europe for the first time in the 18th century, the French translators wanted to make it sound exotic. So they called it the Arabian Nights because it was conjuring up Arabia and, you know, maybe women in belly dancing outfits and hookah pipes. In fact, in Persian and in Arabic and in any other language, if you come across the works, they are called 1001 Nights. And the reason 1001 Nights is so much more appropriate is because the book started out in Persia, but then Arab scholars added to it, Indians, Chinese. The most famous stories, Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad, were added in France by the translators.
Oh, that's interesting. So those were not originally stories that came out of Iran? I mean, the most famous ones,
right.
Sinbad, Aladdin?
Yeah, so in 18th century France, there was a writer and a publisher who became very successful. He was publishing one story a day, and he had this little kiosk, and people would line up around the corner to buy these stories from him. And at the time, there were only 283 stories. So by the time the 284th day came along and he'd run out of stories, he panicked and went to the writer and said, I don't have any more stories to sell. And the writer said, well, that's it. I've translated everything. He said, well, guess what? You're going to have to write a couple more for me because these are selling like hotcakes. Huh. And that's what happened.
So here's the most fascinating part of the whole story. The reason we know the Arabian Nights, or if you prefer, A Thousand and One Nights, the reason they're now part of the canon of world literature is because Europeans fell in love with them. In fact, added to them, even remade them at a time when the Arab world had never considered them anything more than folktales.
It is a European phenomenon.
Mohsen al-Massawi, a prominent scholar of Arabic literature.
Because among the elitist circles in the Arab world until sometime in the 13th century, they thought of these kind of tales as unworthy of being written down. The popular was marginalized, was put aside. It was for the street, for the coffee house audiences, that's all. It was only in Europe, and it was very popular, certainly, with the French. But it was in England that it made its enormous reputation.
So you're saying this is a book that had enormous cultural influence over
the
centuries.
Next to the Bible.
And it wasn't just England. Throughout Europe, people were obsessed with what you might call Oriental exoticism. You find it in the operas of Mozart and the books of Europe's most famous writers. For instance, Voltaire's picaresque novel Candide would be unthinkable without the influence of the Arabian Nights.
You know, there are lots of fairy tales in the world, there are lots of myths in the world, but the Arabian Nights had a very special impact in 18th century Europe. They were just taken up by every kind of writer, artist, opera writer. You know, and then in the streets, people began drinking coffee, people in their houses began wearing embroidered dressing gowns and turbans. You know, if you look at an 18th century portrait of a kind of writer or a nobleman, he will often be wearing a turban and a Turkish dressing gown. And also, above all, this is what really interested me, there's a freedom.
A freedom to step into a fantasy. What's so striking about the European craze for the Arabian Nights is when it happened. In the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, just as the scientific revolution was exploding all across Europe, when rationality finally seemed to knock religion off its pedestal, so people no longer had to believe in the Bible's miracles. But here you have the Arabian Nights with their flying carpets and magic lamps and genies, which must have given people the sense that a world without God could still feel magical and fantastical, strictly through the power of their imagination. Of course, there's also a politics to all of this, and the risk of stereotyping Muslims and Arabs as exotic characters right out of a fairy tale. But even Edward Said, the Palestinian-American cultural critic who wrote the landmark book Orientalism, had a soft spot for the Arabian Nights. He was never willing to write them off as just another example of how the West had colonized the Middle East. And it's one reason people who come from the Middle East have gone back to the Arabian Nights, even to turn them into TV shows for kids.
A thousand and one nights, remarkable sights. with sultans and kings and with magical things from the past.
That's a scene from Big Bad Boo's animated TV series, 1001 Nights, which has aired in dozens of countries around the world, including the Middle East. Shabnam Rezai is the president of her production company.
I'm originally from Iran, and growing up, my father would tell me the tales late at night, and much like Shahrzad, the heroine, who doesn't tell the ending of the story, my father would keep the ending of the story from me, and so I would always be excited for the next night where I had the opportunity to sit with him and hear the rest of the story. So there's great tradition, oral tradition, in passing the stories down from generation to generation.
So you grew up with these stories. Now you live in the United States and also Canada. Why turn them into entertainment for today's children?
Our whole company, Big Bad Boo, is based on the mission and vision of teaching children about different cultures through entertainment. So the idea is to normalize being from a different country. So what's great about 1001 Nights is there are hundreds and hundreds of stories that conjure up genies, viziers, mermaids, evil emperors, and the world is really endless. And in the tradition of 1001 Nights, we are able to embellish and really use our imagination to create something that is modern and appropriate for today's audience.
But Shahrzad, what happened to the flying carpet? I liked that part.
Ah, that's a very good question, Shahzaman. But that would be another story.
Oh, come on, please.
Our backstory on the Arabian Nights, or the 1001 Nights, from Steve Paulson.